Are you looking for ways to attract and retain private pay clients? Thrizer is a payment platform for therapists built to help clients automatically tap into their out-of-network benefits and save on therapy up front. Check out our special link, join.thrizer.com/modern therapist, and use the code modernTherapists to activate $2,500 in free payments with Thrizer.
Simplified SEO Consulting has DIY done with you training and done for you SEO options. So there is truly something to fit every practice owner's SEO needs. Check them out at simplifiedseoconsulting.com/modern therapist and use the code modern therapist for a DIY course or mention the Modern Therapist Survival Guide podcast during your consult for special offers.
You're listening to the Modern Therapist Survival Guide, where therapists live, breathe, and practice as human beings. To support you as a whole person and a therapist, here are your hosts, Kurt Widhelm and Katie Vernoy.
Welcome back, Modern Therapists. This is the Modern Therapist Survival Guide. I'm Kurt Widhelm with Katie Vernoy. And towards the end of last year, we dedicated an episode to the wonderful training program at Drexel University and really talked about the development of Person of the Therapist as a model of training. You all really loved that. That was one of our highest downloaded episodes ever. And one of the people that we talked about as far as being really foundational to those ideas is Dr. Harry Aponte. He is gracious enough to join us as a guest today and talk a little bit about his process and going into that. We're also featuring Dr. Aponte as keynote speaker at our Therapy Reimagined 2020 conference. And for the latest updates on how that is going to play out and what's going to happen, check out our website at mtsgpodcast.com. But we are so thankful and so excited to have Dr. Aponte join us today. So thank you for joining us, Harry.
Glad to be here.
We are so excited to have you. There is a lot that we want to talk to you about, but we ask all of our guests, who are you and what are you putting out into the world?
Well, at a personal level, I'm a New York Puerto Rican. Parents came from Puerto Rico. I was born and raised in New York, Harlem, and South Bronx. I'm an only child. Came from a very troubled family, Catholic. Spent a good part of my life trying to figure out how I fit in this world, because it didn't just come comfortably. Differences in being an ethnic and racial minority, and having essentially grown up in the ghetto, and then getting into the professional world. Well, I guess what says it all is to me is that after I graduated from social work school at Fordham, I went for postgraduate training at the Menninger Clinic in Topeka, Kansas. And as the first time I actually met and had conversation with white Anglo-Saxon people. So that's you know, white people to me were the Irish kids and the Italian kids and their gangs, you know, so we were all ghettoized within the ghetto. That was my world. All of that was then, when I got into the professional world, it also was complicated because going to the Menninger Clinic, it was a psychoanalytic environment. Very classical psychoanalytic. The first hospital that tried to put into practice Freud's principles into a in-hospital environment. Murray Bowen came from there. Nathan Ackerman was trained there. So we had a few of our predecessors and founders of family therapy and systemic thinking coming out of the Menninger Clinic, you know. And so there we came from an environment where you learned Freud's idea of, he actually used the words that the posture of the therapist should be that of a surgeon, and not personally involved in with your clients. And at the same time, though, his theory and technique was based on something that to me felt very personal, which had to do with transference and countertransference.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was there for 8 years. And then Sal Mnuchin had moved from New York to Philadelphia. And he invited me to come work in Philadelphia. And I think part of what the reason why he invited me was because I'm Puerto Rican. And the clinic, the child guidance clinic in Philadelphia, was situated in a Black neighborhood. Mm. And I had grown up actually not in Spanish Harlem, even though I was born there. I grew up in Black Harlem, the only Latin family in that environment. So it was a very comfortable and welcoming environment to me. And I assume that that's why, one of the reasons why he invited me to come work with him in Philly. He had only been there a few years and really experimenting with working the structural approach in the neighborhood, completely in the neighborhood where our clients came from, which contrasted, even though Sal was very focused on technique, but it also contrasted with what we were getting from, I remember Virginia Satir and Don Jackson came to Menninger's and spoke with us, and she came with California thinking. You know,
the crazy California thinking.
Yeah, well, you know, but it, you know, because she came from a place where she used the words like intimacy when she spoke about the relationship between the therapist and the client, which was quite unlike the concept of being a surgeon with a anesthetized patient. You know, so I had to deal with that. What I'm saying is that all of my personal background and as well as the professional exposure that I had, all it did was to make me reflect and reflect and reflect and think deeply about what about me in this world and what about mm-hmm. me when I'm sitting down with these people who are very strange to me and I have trouble communicating with, and I have to somehow empathize with them and understand them, and they have to understand me and believe me that I'm really there yeah. for them, and all of that, so that the whole business of forming a relationship was demanded of me some serious thinking, you know. And then the contrast when I was came into Philadelphia and was working with the African American population there, where I felt immediately comfortable and related without any, it was no barrier that I experienced, mm-hmm. which was so different when I used to do workshops, when we used to do live family sessions. And I remember in those days, people were inviting me to talk about structural family therapy. And what they would do at the workshops most often was to bring their most difficult, you know, low income, you know, underorganized families for me to see. And what always stuck in my mind, just was imprinted, was the times when I heard them say, well, these people don't talk. So my reaction was, well, maybe they don't talk to you, but they certainly talk to each other. You know, so that both in my personal life and in my professional life, there were bridges to cross and barriers to overcome. And that made me very self-aware. I didn't take the relationship for granted.
Yeah.
I was very conscious of the relationship, and I was very conscious of the challenges that the relationship involved, and I could see the differences in the work that I did from the work that I saw others who didn't have my background do with the same families that I was working with. It rather naturally came to me to be sensitive to myself and who I am and what I bring to the experience of being with clients, whether they were clients who were foreign to me in terms of their ethnicity, in terms of their race, in mm-hmm. terms of their cultural backgrounds, as well as being with people who to me felt more in sync with what I knew from my growing up. You know, so the work of thinking about the self of the therapist came quite naturally to me. In fact, I just couldn't avoid it. And so
it sounds like it.
Yeah. So I had to give it a lot of thought, and I just incorporated it into my work, the work that I was doing. In fact, when I think I was at the child guidance clinic, I don't know, 11 years or whatever it was, quite a while. But I couldn't talk there about the person of the therapist. Sal was interested in technique. And I used to then talk about the self of the therapist when I used to do workshops and in my writing. But that was outside the clinic, which was really very strange.
Thrizer is a payment platform designed for out-of-network therapy. As a therapist, you would use Thrizer to charge clients for sessions and collect your full rate up front. From the client's perspective, Thrizer links to their health plan, so insurance claims are automatically submitted for them upon every charge. From there, Thrizer manages the claims end-to-end so that your clients don't have to worry about manually submitting super bills or getting on calls with insurance. The best part? Thrizer allows clients to only pay their co-insurance portion for sessions, while Thrizer covers the rest of your fee and waits for reimbursement on their behalf.
They also offer you an instant benefits calculator for free, allowing you to provide upfront transparency to prospective clients on their out-of-network coverage. Therapists only pay a standard 3% credit card processing fee per session with no additional fees. Visit join.thrizer.com/modern therapist to get started and use our promo code Modern Therapists to receive $2,500 in waived fees for your sessions.
How was that particular piece accepted? Because for our listeners who aren't familiar with Harry's career, and I'm really glad that you've kind of shared the story so far, because there was a hot minute there where eco-structural therapy was what you were writing about. But I'm imagining Sal coming to you and saying, Harry, that's fine. Do that outside of the clinic here, but don't cross the streams here.
Well, he never said that to me. He just ignored it. You know, but you know, the story I tell was that when I first got there early on, he put me in charge of the clinical services, and he focused on the training, and he was training people from the community actually. To be lay people, to become therapists, which was a great concept. But he asked me to handle the clinical work, but there was trouble in the community. This was in the late 60s, early 70s, and people in the community had organized, and they wanted to be sort of an advisory board to the clinic, but an advisory board that would tell us how we should work. And he, with some of the higher administrative people, were meeting with that group, and it wasn't going very well. So then he invited me to figure, well, okay, this guy maybe can better communicate with these people from the community. And well, we sat down one day, and the first time I joined the meeting, and so there were, like, you know, I don't know, 15 or so people from the community there, and four or five of the administrators from the child guidance clinic. And it was a back and forth, and I was just keeping quiet. I didn't really know a whole lot about what was going on. And then community people said, well, you know, we need to counsel among ourselves. So you white people get out, because we need to. So I sat there and I thought for a minute. I don't think he meant what he said. I don't think he realized what he just said. So I sat. And Sal got up with the other administrators, and they looked at me. Why wasn't I going out with them? And I didn't say a word. What was I going to say to them? You know? And so they walked out. They weren't too happy with me. You know, it was like Tonto had left, you know, the Lone Ranger and went to talk with the Indians who were coming to attack. The group there, they were uncomfortable with me. They didn't address me. I was just sitting there, you know, like this sore thumb. And then finally said, oh, well, you know, excuse us. We don't want to insult you, but... You know, this is a community group, and you know, I said, I understand what you're saying, but you were talking about white people, you know, and I don't consider myself a white person, and I have as much African background as some of you do. So if you really wanted, you know, the people from the clinic to leave, you should have said that, but that's not what you said. They left me there. and they didn't throw me out. And so after that, I started to meet with them myself, you know. Sal did not come and meet with them. And then they got pretty aggressive about they were going to run the clinic, basically. That's how I heard it. And I said, no, you're not. I said, you know, if that's what you intend to do, that's the end of our meetings. I had no problem speaking up. I felt perfectly comfortable in calling them on that. And I said, I'd be happy to have you involved and hear from you, but I'm not going to have you try to run the clinic. And so that was the end of the meetings. And then I went out into the community and I started to ask, who runs this community? Where's the leadership from the community? And to make a very long story short, I found out it was a guy named Jim Lester, who was a so-called activist at that time, an African-American activist, and a very scary guy who had confrontations with Frank Rizzo, the mayor of Philadelphia.
Oh, wow.
And he and the cops were not in very good standing, but I think everybody was afraid of Jim. But it was also, he oversaw the South Philly, and the gangs were pretty much under his control there. He kept them from fighting with each other and killing each other. They were there, but there was a certain discipline that he imposed on that part of the community. And one day, the clinic had given me freedom to meet with him, and they supported it. So he and I would meet in the bars and have a drink. And I said, hey, Jim, you know, you're very good with the kids. We're very good with families. Why don't we work together? And he liked the idea. And so we talked about it. And we said, well, why don't we get a hold of the kids who are truants, who are not going to class? And he said, well, you know, how do we even find out who they are? And how do we get access to them? I said, well, that's the advantage that I have of being at the Child Guidance Clinic. Because I know the superintendent of schools in this district, and you and I can go meet with him. And so we met with the guy and told them what we had in mind, that we had in mind setting up a school, an alternative school, for the kids who were not attending class. And he said, well, if you can get them to attend class, who don't ever attend class in the public schools, good luck to you, but it has to be after 3 o'clock. You can't compete with us. He said, okay. Jim put pressure on one of the radio stations, and it was also a TV station, to let us do a telethon. And we did a telethon, raised money, bought a building.
Oh, my goodness.
And Jim went over to the University of Penn, to their School of Education, and got the black students there who were learning to be teachers, and got them to volunteer and use this as a practicum for themselves.
Oh my goodness.
So we had a school, you know, and then we all contacted the families. We had a list of all the kids who weren't attending class, and we contacted the families, told them what we were doing, and Jim set up a school, trying to make something that was very long and complicated very simple. But it was set up, and we had classes going. And think about this. I mean, we're talking about kids who were not going to school at all. Well, Jim said to them, to the kids, class begins at 3:30. And if you're not here by 3:30, we lock the doors. Well, I went down and I would observe from a hiding place to see what would happen at 3:30. And kids were running to get to class.
Oh, wow.
Running to get into the school. And we tested those kids, and in a few months, they just jumped grades. I mean, they were doing wonderfully in the schools. It was a whole new experience for them. They loved it, and they were very disciplined. And if the teachers weren't disciplined, he threw them out. And we got people who were disciplined, who came from Penn who were disciplined and knew how to behave properly and be respectful of the kids. And then when I became the director of the clinic of child guidance, and Sal was still doing the training piece of it, I then incorporated that portion of the schooling into the clinic itself.
Oh, wow.
So we had it going in the clinic, and the parents came into the clinic, and the parents invited other parents to come in. And so the whole eco-structural thing came out of that. So that while Sal was focusing on the families, I was focusing on the families with community, with the environment, knowing, at least convinced that, and knowing in my heart that if we were going to make a difference in their lives, we also had to make a difference in the community. So I had city council, I had representatives from the state coming in, African-American city councilmen and representatives come in, get to know the clinic, give us access to the licensing and inspection people, to the police, to all the city resources, so that if the therapist needed connections to get resources for the families, they were there and they knew us. And we had people to contact there. We could make a phone call and actually get through. And somebody could actually listen to us.
I just imagine, like, this is amazing. And this is so wonderful that you were able to identify this need and create such a huge impact in this community. I'm just thinking about if you had remained a surgeon with a anesthetized patient, like, none of this would have happened. And I, you know, you talk about like that modality of thinking about things, as well as Sal's, like, let's focus on the intervention. When I think about what you were doing in the background there, why do you think so many people were ignoring themselves in the situation and how they could connect on a human to human level and actually make a difference? Because it seems like you had such a strong experience of bringing yourself and having yourself be important in this role. And it was so different from what everybody else was talking about or were even willing to look at. I mean, Sal ignored it. Why do you think that was the case?
Well, you know, it wasn't like Sal ignored it. I think he was aware of it. But, you know, I mean, he came from Argentina. You know, he has his roots in Israel and in Argentina. That's a certain environment. And Virginia Satir, where does she come from? Murray Bowen, where did he come from? Mm-hmm. Okay. So these were all great people, and you know, Oswald, you know, they were interested in the community. Sal clearly was interested in the community. You know, that's the Families of the Slums. That was his first book. So it's not that they ignored it, but I grew up in it.
Mm.
Okay, I lived it. Okay, so I also knew firsthand what it was like to not have the resources readily available. Okay, not to be able to make contact with people who had any kind of influence. Okay, so it's one thing to go into a therapist's office or even have a therapist come to your home. Okay, but it's another thing to then be out in the community and have all these resources out there, and they were out of reach. Mm-hmm. You know, and you were treated differently.
Yeah.
You know, in these places. So this was in me. This was part of who I was. You know, it came naturally to me in a way that it would not have come naturally to these people who had the concept. You know, I mean, think about it. I mean, Sal did Families of the Slums. Sal, you know, did his work. He took the Wiltwyck School and he brought it into the community itself, in effect. And Oswald was working with the community. So these people were not insensitive to this. But they also didn't have a certain natural instinct that comes from actually growing up in it and living with it and the frustration of it. Okay. It added a whole other dimension to it. And by the way, if you read, I think it was called the Family Therapy Networker at the time. And Sal did an article there a year or two before he died. And in that article, he talked about how it wasn't technique that made the difference. It was the therapist and the personality.
Vindication.
it was there.
I want to use this as kind of a jumping off point, because you've so colorfully illustrated the impact that you had, not just with the clients that you're working with, but also the broader systems within the community and the interventions that you've led there. So many of the training programs for therapists now don't even teach the concept of having that kind of influence. They see it as outside the scope of the therapist. They see that as outside the role of the positions that we're in. But this is where it seems like the way that we're training therapists now and the way that therapists learn what really works and what's actually impactful for clients seem to be really two separate worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And you've, you know, bridged that with your work at Drexel. You really started popularizing the person of the therapist training there right around the time that every other program was going the other direction back into it's just about techniques.
Right.
Can you talk about how you've continued to stand on your own and do it successfully in this way that really does add this robust, good therapeutic training model that can continue to serve clients, not just at the individual or the family level, but within the bigger systems?
This is who I am, okay? And this is how I think. Mm-hmm. And whether anybody listened to me or not, I didn't know any other way to do it except the way that made sense to me.
I like it.
You know, I went through my training and the schooling and all this and that. My parents still, you know, live in South Bronx, and I had to go through the painful years even then of when they were ill, when trying to get them services at Lincoln Hospital in New York, services for their eyes and for all their physical ailments, and how difficult it was for them to get the resources that they needed. And they were still there, and I was in Philadelphia, and my frustration in reaching out to the community to try to mobilize these things and make them accessible to my parents, and how difficult it was. So I was living this in those years. I mean, I still remember my father was dying, and he said he was dying. He told me he was dying. And he went to Lincoln Hospital, and they looked at him there, and they said, oh, you know, you're not sick enough to stay in the hospital. And he says to me, Harry, I'm dying. And he calls me, and I was about to go do a workshop in Ann Arbor. And I said, you know, I can't leave you telling me this. I'm in Philadelphia. I'm supposed to go to Ann Arbor. And mm-hmm. you're telling me you're dying, and the hospital discharges you saying you're not sick enough. To me, they just didn't understand. So I called Lincoln Hospital. And I had the chutzpah to call and said, I want to talk to the person in charge of the hospital. Mm-hmm. And strangely enough, they put me to the guy, and I got the guy on the phone immediately. I don't know how that happened. That was an act of God, you know. And I said to him, listen, I'm about to do some training of people in Ann Arbor. My father tells me he's sick and he's dying. I can't leave my father in this state. And he sounds to me like he's in really in bad straits. And the guy said, all right. He says, I'll make sure that, have him come back. I'll make sure that he gets hospitalized. You can go ahead. I said, I'm not going anywhere until he's in the hospital and you call me and tell me that he's in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
He said, all right. You know, so later on that day, you know, my father went. They admitted him. I got the call. I went to Ann Arbor. That night, my wife called me. Oh, your father died.
Mm.
But he was in a hospital. And they were attending to him. And they listened. But my God, you know, having to go through all that trouble to make it happen. You know, how many people there had a son who would be able to call and get the person who could make a decision, you know, and make things happen. So, you know, this is in my blood.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm taking away from this that when we enter into this profession, when we've had to bring our own experiences into every single situation, whether it's something that is for the greater change of the people that we work with, or whether it's deeply impactful to us as individuals, that we can't ignore both. That we can't, one does not exist without the other. And this is, you know, really where we've been big fans of Harry and his work for a very long time, and have had a couple of conversations with him leading up to this podcast, and have really enjoyed the wit and kind of the pathway that he's blazed through a lot of his career. Because as we mentioned in the previous episode on how to be a therapist, of we love when people have done the research for us and provided the body of work of the things that we encourage. And I'm so proud that we get to share this space with Harry, because this is a lifetime, an example of a lifetime of standing up for what you believe in, knowing that what works is not just the techniques that you read out of a book, that as much as the influences around therapy seem to make it come faster, come cheaper, get people out the door, that there's a very deep personal impact in this. And that's not independent of the life that we have in our own lives. And sometimes we end up with really, really tough personal situations that impact that. And that's part of the human factor of being a therapist.
Simplified SEO Consulting's team of mental health professionals genuinely want to help you attract more of your ideal clients with a proven on-page SEO process using the strategies that are most effective for therapist websites. They know SEO is an investment, which is why it is so important to find someone who aligns with your values and understands the importance of building your private practice in a meaningful way. Simplified SEO Consulting hopes to be that team for you and your practice.
The expert team would love to talk with you during a free consultation to figure out the best fit for your SEO journey. Simplified SEO Consulting has DIY, done with you training, and done for you SEO options. So there's truly something to fit every practice owner's SEO needs. Be sure to ask if their innovative content network is a good fit for your website. Listeners of this podcast can get 20% off a DIY SEO course with code MODERNTHERAPIST, or mention the Modern Therapist Survival Guide podcast during your free consultation for $100 off your done-for-you SEO program onboarding this spring.
Check them out at simplifiedseoconsulting.com/modern-therapist.
I think to add to that, Kurt, is I'm just so struck with your story, Harry, about how your personal life experience has made it impossible for you to see it any other way, to do anything different.
Yeah.
And to me, it just really highlights the privilege that had designed therapy before, believing that somehow we didn't need to exist in the room, or we weren't relevant to the room, and not recognizing the full needs of the clients before us, to have people who truly understand and are able to not just do an intervention, but to advocate and inform and to design systems that actually will make a difference. And to me, being a WASPy white woman, you know, I'm always struck when I'm able to more fully recognize how privileged I am and what I would not have thought to bring into the room. And I think that's why, you know, even in this idea that we could be blank screens or surgeons or any of these things, like it just feels so, I don't know what the right word is, just ridiculous. Maybe I'll just go with ridiculous. Like it feels so ridiculous that we could actually not have a personal relationship or not bring any of ourselves into the room. And granted, Freud nodded to it with countertransference, right? And there are systems and there are all those things. But to me, I'm just so struck with how you naturally and organically were able to identify the differences with how you were interacting with the clients or the community members around the clinic, when the therapists or the counselors or the folks who were creating these things did not recognize what that barrier was to connecting. They just didn't talk, or they just didn't understand. It was something where the notion of looking into yourself and your experience was obvious to you, but completely not to folks who were so privileged to not have to understand it in the same way. I don't know if I'm making sense, but to me, I really appreciate that. And I'm curious, because I think you're very humble and saying, well, this is just how I think. This is just how I couldn't do it any other way. And I believe that that's true, but I also believe that many people wouldn't be able to put that together into something like the person of the therapist training. And so I'm going to steal one of Kurt's questions, because I think it's so relevant, which is, how do you think clinical education for therapists, social workers, psychologists, how do you think it should change? Because I think if Kurt and I had our way, person of the therapist training would be required. So looking at, not everyone's necessarily going to adopt the whole program, what do you think, at the minimum, do clinical programs need to do before therapists really can enter into this work effectively?
You know, I'll tell another story.
We love your stories.
Yeah, well, I think they illustrate better than I can conceptualize some of this myself. I had been invited to do some teaching as an adjunct at Drexel on structural family therapy. And then there was a change of leadership there. A woman named Marlene Watson became in charge of the couples and family therapy program. She's African-American. She had seen some of my work, and she was interested in what we're talking about, given where she was coming from. She's very interested in social justice. And so I said, well, this is what I'm doing. I was doing my training on my own, training people on the use of self and with this perspective. And she said, can you bring it into our clinic? And I said, well, I think I can, but with one condition. That she said, what's that? I said, I think your faculty needs to be exposed to it first, and they have to be into it, because I don't want to be, you know, another little class that's being taught on the side here among 10 others, because I think this is very much to the core of what's necessary for the development of a therapist. I don't think this is just something that we add on, you know. And she said, all right, we'll do it. I mean, that was that quick. And I said, well, can you get them together? She said, sure. And she said, and I'll be the first one to present.
And nice. So
she was the first one to present. She presented her work and exposed herself and some of her own issues in supervising. So that's what she offered for me to work on with her. And I did it with all the faculty that was there, the five or six core faculty that was there. And she said, we're going to make this, you know, a cornerstone of our training program. So she made a full commitment to
That's
it.
So good.
Okay.
That's
great. And gave me everything that I asked for. You know, I said, I don't want to do this by myself. I can't. I want a co-leader. I'd like to have a woman. I said, I have my perspective, but women have their own perspective. And I'd like to just expand our perspectives on this. And so that's what she arranged for. So we designed the program. The program was also labor intensive, which is one of the reasons we can talk about this a little later, but you know, why I don't think the program is being used in too many places. Okay. Although people are hearing about it in many places, you know, including Africa, Asia, and so on, getting correspondence all the time about this program in other continents, but it is labor intensive. And so I designed a program that had three basic components to it. First component was that you as a therapist who want to be a therapist, you need to know yourself. And in particular, a wrinkle that I added, which is not too common in the field, which is you also need to know and be able to speak to your own hangups.
Yeah.
I'm painfully conscious of my hangups. and I always was, and I still am. And I know how difficult it is to change. And I know what kind of problems it creates for my relationships. And I know how how things that I have to overcome in order to do some decent clinical work. But I also know that for me to be able to not just hear people and observe them, but also to feel them, I have to be in touch with my own experience of life, with my own struggles of life. Okay. And when I do my clinical work, I do part of what I learned from psychoanalysis. I free associate as I'm engaging with people. And so as they're telling me about their troubles, I'm remembering mine. I'm remembering my experiences, my trauma, my failures, my hangups, my problems in trying to change, my suffering around these things. And I have them, they're there, you know, and it's automatically there. And what it does is it opens me up to feel with them. So when they talk about their pain and their hurt and their insecurities, I'm right with you, buddy. You know, I don't tell them, but I'm with you, and then I can begin to intuit you. I can begin to get a sense of what you're going through, and not just depend on your words to understand what you're going through. You know, and then when I do an enactment, which came from Sal, and people can bring their and live their issues right there in the room with me. Okay, it's for real. And they're doing their thing, and I'm feeling it, and I can enter it, and I can engage them in it, and be with them fully myself, okay? In the sense that it just opens me up to resonate, to identify with, to associate to the things that I'm experiencing. So that's why my saying about therapy, that therapy is not a conversation, it's an experience.
Yeah.
It's going to make an impact in people's lives. But that has to be disciplined.
And
okay. Especially if you're getting into things that are truly sensitive to you, that are truly hurtful, traumatized, a part of you, you need to be on top of it. You know, otherwise it can overwhelm you in there and paralyze you, can freeze you in the session. You can act out on it in ways that are destructive to yourself and to your client. So then I developed a program that says, let's spend this, we have three quarters. So let's spend this first quarter with you taking turns and writing up so that I can read it and my co-leader can read it. You know, tell me about who you are. Tell me about what your core issues are, personal issues are. Tell me how you think this is going to affect your clinical work as you begin to get cases. And this is first year people.
Yeah.
And you're going to do this in the presence of your cohort.
Yeah, that sounds overwhelming.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. And, you know, it's like the first person who's going to do this is like saying to them, all right, strip, take your clothes off, you know, in front of your cohort. But I also know, you know, how sensitive it is. I know how secretive I am about my own stuff. And so I'm very sensitive to be protective of them and to be very clear with them. Listen, if there's something that you don't want to talk about, you don't want to put out there, keep it to yourself. I understand that. That's not a problem. But I want you to be conscious of it.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about it. When you talk about it, I'm going to be there. Yes, I'm going to explore with you. I'm going to try to help you to conceptualize it. I'm going to try to help you to put words to it. I'm going to help you to be able to converse with yourself about it so that it begins to make sense. I want you to get desensitized to the emotions that overwhelm you when you connect with all of these experiences, with all of these associations, so that then you can actually use it and work with
it.
This has to be instrumental for you. Okay, so this is a training. This isn't just reading about something and saying, "Oh, that's a nice idea." You know,
you mean my whole grad school experience of, "Ooh, this sounds like a good idea." That wasn't effective.
That wasn't effective, right? So I say to them, you know, I say to them, you don't train a football player by showing them videos about great football games. You know, you have to get out there and do it. And get bruised in doing it so that it becomes something that's automatic to you, you know, something that just naturally comes up for you and you're able to say, oh, this will help me in relating to my client. This will help me in in resonating with my client and in being sensitive to what they're going through, this is going to help me to really make an assessment.
Yeah.
You know, I can get a real idea as to what they're really going through. I can get an idea as to really why it's so difficult for them to change, because I'm getting deeper into their experience. They're not just telling me that they're depressed and they're staying in bed. I'm understanding why, and I'm getting a feel for why they're depressed and in bed, okay, and what makes it so hard for them to get out of bed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I conduct this session with them in the presence of the cohort, and they talk about it. They would joke about it, a lot of them. They say, okay, yeah, this is the crying session with Harry. You know, so we have to have a lot of, you know, tissues there. And I understand that because I cry myself, you know, around this stuff. And so they would talk about it. I want them to conceptualize it. In the second quarter, I'm saying, now I want to show you how to take this and have you give life to the work that you're doing clinically, technically. Yeah. Okay, but you have to go to school, you have to learn the various schools of therapy, you have to learn the techniques, you have to learn about psychopathology. All this stuff is absolutely essential. But this stuff, these are tools. Okay, these are tools that you will make use of through your human relationship and connection that you're having with your clients. So I want you to be able to give life to that. Life that really connects with your clients and makes an impact on them. You'll have a sense of where they really are, what they're going through, how they're relating to you, how much they trust you. You'll have a sense of timing. Okay, now I can say it. Now I can do it. You have a sense of, this is how I should do it. This is the kind of personality I have. I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm 6 feet tall, I'm 5 feet two. You know, I have this personality, I have that personality. I have to do it in a way that makes sense to who I am and who that person or that family or that couple is. Okay. I want you to have that kind of experience. In other words, I'm trying to train you to master yourself within the context of being in the role of being a therapist. Okay. And so we're going to do role plays, and you're going to bring in videos of your work, so that I can see it. But I'm more interested in the role play. When you do the role play, we're going to have people from your class are going to role play couples and families, okay? And they're your clients. And they're going to have the experience of you trying to relate to them. And you'll have a sense of what it's like to have somebody trying to connect with you, you know? And I want to sit right behind you. And every few minutes, I want to stop and say, okay, what's happening with you now? What are you thinking? What are you feeling? Why are you only talking to this person? You're not talking to that person, you know? Oh, well, because, well, you know, like I've had experience in class a number of times, you know, I have an African-American client and then married to a white woman as a guy, and the therapist is only relating to the African-American. And I say, why are you doing that? Why are you ignoring her? Well, she's privileged. You know, she doesn't suffer the way the black person does. Oh, really? So she doesn't suffer, huh? You don't suffer, you know? And so we go through that and say, oh, is that what we're talking about? So we're talking about a transformation. We're talking about something's revolutionary. Okay, we're talking about creating something and training a person to say, who I am is really important and at the very heart of the work that I'm doing. And I have to be an instrument that knows how to use these tools that I'm being trained to use. And so by the third quarter, we have paid actors who then I supervise with the students, working with them. And I work with them in the same way, making them aware of themselves, making them have conscious use of themselves so that they could make all of this technical training that they're getting and learning, they can make it useful and effective.
I just love that program because to me, it feels like such a relief to think about being myself in the room is not only allowed, it's important. And being able to do what we do naturally, which is free associate and try to connect with the person across from us and understand their experience through our own experiences instead of trying to, you know, put those away, put those away. This is about the client. This is about the client. Like that to me feels so important and so validating that I can be a person in the room and I, in fact, I should be. And it's the only way that I can really do this work effectively. I feel like we could talk with you for hours and hours and hours, but we are so low on time. I'm so glad that we get to have to continue this. I was going to say conversation, but I'll call it experience, to continue this experience together in September. Thank you so much for being here.
I'm very happy to be here and have a chance to put it out there so that somebody can hear it and somebody takes it seriously as you're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a number of things that Harry has mentioned during this episode. We will put links to those in our show notes. You can find those at mtsgpodcast.com. And like I said, we have Harry slated to be one of our keynote speakers at the Therapy Reimagined 2020 conference. Just like everywhere else in the world right now, we are watching the whole health situation. We are constantly making tweaks to how our event is going to be presented and exploring all of our options. And for the most up-to-date news on that, check out our website, and we would love to have you join us and join Harry. And until next time, I'm Kurt Woodhelm with Katie Vernoy and Dr. Harry Aponte.
Thank you for listening to the Modern Therapist Survival Guide. Learn more about who we are and what we do at mtsgpodcast.com. You can also join us on Facebook and Twitter. And please don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any of our episodes.
Remember to check out Thrizer. They are passionate about making out-of-network therapy work for everyone. Clients save upfront on therapy while therapists earn their full rate. Get started in minutes on join.thrizer.com/modern therapist and use the promo code Modern Therapists and receive $2,500 in waived fees for your sessions.
Don't forget, we have some special offers from our partner, Simplified SEO Consulting. Get 20% off a DIY SEO course with the code MODERNTHERAPIST or mention the Modern Therapist Survival Guide podcast during your free consultation for $100 off of your onboarding to the Done For You SEO program. Check them out at simplifiedseoconsulting.com/modern therapist.